That's my favorite part of this process. Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel as well. My name is Dan Ashley, the news anchor for ABC 7 Television in San Francisco, KGO-TV, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's program, and proud to be so. Now it's time to introduce our distinguished speaker today. It is no secret that there are at least 16 Republican candidates seeking the party's presidential nomination, and that those leading the pack do not represent traditional politics in many respects. Today we are very pleased to have with us Dr. Ben Carson, who since the first presidential debate is now running very close in the race, just behind Donald Trump in Iowa and New Hampshire, and he has surged in the polls in recent weeks. A little background. Born to a single mother in Detroit, Ben Carson was raised in poverty. He says the love of reading changed the course of his life, and in 1968 he was admitted to Yale University. He went on to receive his MD from the University of Michigan Medical School. Dr. Carson became the chief of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital in 1984 at the age of 33, making him the youngest major division director in the hospital's history. Dr. Carson's accomplishments have earned him a place in medical history. Notably, he performed the first and only successful separation of Siamese twins joined at the back of the head. That was in 1987. Dr. Carson has written 8 books, 3 of which were co-authored with his wife of 39 years, Candy, who is with us today. He is also the recipient. Delighted to have you here, Candy. He is also the recipient of the 2006 Spingarn Medal, the highest honor bestowed by the NAACP, and in June of 2008, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor in the land. Dr. Carson and his wife are co-founders of the Carson Scholars Fund, which recognizes young people of all backgrounds for exceptional academic and humanitarian accomplishments. The fund is currently operating in 50 states and the District of Columbia and has awarded more than $6.7 million to more than 6,700 scholars. In 2014, the Gallup organization in their annual survey named Dr. Carson one of the 10 most admired men in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, a big welcome for Dr. Ben Carson. Dr. Carson, the Spingarn Award, the Medal of Freedom, 10 most admired men in the world. What is a nice guy like you doing in a race like this?
Well, that's a very good question. It certainly was not one of the things on my bucket list. And I was really, and my wife Candy, we were really looking forward to a nice relaxing retirement after a very arduous career. And then in 2013, along came the National Prayer Breakfast. And that kind of changed the dynamic. After that, there were so many people clamoring for me to run for president, which I thought was kind of a ridiculous idea. But I kept running into particularly elderly Americans who told me they had given up on America and they were just waiting to die. I heard that so many times. It really started to bother me. Mm. And hundreds of thousands of people clamoring and saying, you need to do this. And I started thinking, could I really relax? You know, we bought a beautiful home on a golf course in Florida. I bought an organ because I always wanted to learn how to play the organ. All those books you save up the last few years before you retire, you know, I was going to read them, and all the movies you never saw. You know, people are shocked when I tell them I never saw Rocky. But, you know.
That is shocking.
I was going to do all this stuff. But I think the Lord had a different plan. So we will just, you know, continue down this road. You know, I don't deny the fact that I'm a person of faith. And I just said, Lord, you know, this is not something that I particularly wish to do, but if you really want me to do it, you'll have to open the doors. Because all the pundits and all the experts say it's impossible for someone like me. to put together a national organization, to be able to raise adequate funds and do all the things that are necessary, which kind of comforted me hearing that. But, you know, anyway. But I said, if you really want me to do it, you'll have to open the doors. And if you open the doors, I'll walk through them. And if you close the doors, I'll gladly sit down.
And watch Rocky.
And watch Rocky. But fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, he keeps opening the doors. And so we'll keep walking through because, you know, America is a terrific place and it's worth saving as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we're going to get into all of the issues in this campaign, but I think let's start the conversation, if we can, Dr. Carson, with a little bit about you as a person, and then we'll get to you as a candidate and a potential political leader. Born in poverty, raised by a single mother, really in so many respects it's an American success story because there's so many people that come from difficult circumstances. Something that I find really interesting is that you said reading changed your life, and I want you to tell me a little bit more about how and why that happened. What did you read first that sparked that?
Yeah, well, you know, my mother always had a dream of education. She grew up in rural Tennessee in a very dilapidated, horrendous situation, shuffled from home to home, able to cobble together no more than a third grade education by the time she was 13 when she got married, trying to escape that environment. Moved to Detroit years later, discovered my father was a bigamist, so there she was, you know, trying to raise us by herself. It was very difficult, and she worked extraordinarily hard. 2-3 jobs at a time, leaving at 5 in the morning, getting back after midnight because she didn't want to be on welfare. And people were telling her, you got 2 boys, you know, you can be on this program and that program. But she just didn't like the idea of being dependent on anybody else. But she also very much felt that education was the key. And when I wasn't doing well, my brother wasn't doing well, you know, she prayed for wisdom and came up with this idea of turning off the TV. You know, as far as my brother and I were concerned, it was child abuse. But to add insult to injury, then we had to read 2 books apiece from the Detroit Public Libraries every week and submit to her written book reports, which she couldn't read, but we didn't know that, you know? I mean,
is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. She put little check marks and highlights, underlines, you know. We would think she was reading them, but she wasn't. But you know, as much as I hated that, and I did hate it, I got to tell you. And her friends used to criticize her, by the way. They said, you can't make boys stay in the house reading books. They'll grow up and they'll hate you. And I used to overhear them and I would say, Mother, you know they're right. But it didn't matter. You know? We still had to do it.
But didn't work. Yeah.
But as I started reading about people, it had a real transformative effect because you know, one of the first books I read was a book called Up From Slavery, the autobiography of Booker T. Washington. And it was illegal for slaves to read. But he taught himself to read, read everything he could get his hands on, became an advisor to 2 presidents. And I read about all kinds of people. And I began to understand that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you in life is you. It's not somebody else. It's not the environment. And that was incredibly liberating for me because I used to hate poverty. You know, some people hate rats and some people hate snakes. I hated poverty. That is until I started reading all those books. And then I didn't mind it anymore.
Explain that.
Well, because then I knew that it was only temporary, that I had the ability to change it, that I had the ability to create the lifestyle that I wanted depending on how hard I was willing to work to get it. And I was willing to work very hard to get it. Therefore, I knew it was going to be only temporary. And that, to me, is something that is so important because I developed what's known as the can-do attitude. And that was the very thing that characterized the rapid rise of America from nothing to the pinnacle of the world. And right now, it's being replaced with the what-can-you-do-for-me attitude. And we need to get rid of that and reinstill the can-do attitude. And it's so essential that we get that in all of our population. because we only have 330 million people. And we're competing with China with over a billion people, India over a billion people. We need to develop all of our people. And we need to see us as a unit working together and recognizing that everyone that we can create success in is a person that we don't have to worry about or be afraid of or support in the penal system or the welfare system, and a person who is tax-paying member of society and may discover a new energy source with a cure for cancer. So we can't afford to throw any of our people away.
Is it fair to say that your life could have gone in a very different direction from whence you came? Was there a real risk of that at some point?
There was a tremendous risk of that. I had a horrible temper. I was one of those people who thought they had a lot of rights. If you know anybody like that, you know. Those are people who are always angry because somebody's always infringing on their rights. I remember once a fellow hit me with a pebble. It didn't hurt, but I was incensed that he would dare hit me with a pebble. And I picked up a large rock, hurled it at his face, broke his glasses, almost put his eye out. Another time, a fellow was trying to close my locker at school. I didn't want it closed. I struck him in the forehead with my fist. Unfortunately, still had the lock in my hand, put a 3-inch gash in his forehead. My mother was trying to get me to wear something. I didn't want to wear it. Picked up a hammer, went to hit her in the head with it. Fortunately, my brother caught it from behind. Other than that, I was a pretty good kid. But you can see how that temper can really create a problem for you. And, you know, when I was 14, another youngster angered me, and I had a large camping knife, and I tried to stab him in the abdomen with it.
I feel I should move my chair. Because the questions are going to get tougher here in a minute.
And fortunately, he had a large metal belt buckle under his clothing. The knife blade struck with such force that it broke, and he fled in terror. But I was more horrified than he as I realized I was trying to kill somebody. I locked myself in the bathroom and started contemplating my life and realizing that I would never realize my dream of becoming a physician with a temper like that. And I just fell on my knees, and I prayed, and there was a Bible there, and I picked it up and opened to the book of Proverbs.
Were you a religious, were you born again at that time or not?
Theoretically, but not in actuality. And as I started reading from the book of Proverbs, there were all these verses in there about fools. And it seemed like they were all written about me. And then there were all these verses about anger. Like Proverbs 19:19, there's no point getting an angry man out of trouble. He's just going to get right back into it. But also verses like Proverbs 16:32, mightier is the man who can control his temper than the man who can conquer a city. And for hours, 3 hours, I stayed in there reading, contemplating, praying. And I came to an understanding during those 3 hours that to react, to punch somebody in the face, to kick down a door was not a sign of strength, but rather a sign of weakness. And it meant that you could be easily manipulated by other people. And I also realized it was a sign of selfishness to always be angry because it's always about me, my, and I. Somebody did this to me, they're in my space, you know, all this kind of stuff. And when I came out of that bathroom after 3 hours, I was a different person. I've never had another angry outburst since that day.
Literally.
Yeah.
That may have been the most productive 3 hours you ever spent in your life.
I think it was. Yeah. It's particularly useful now because you'll notice that the people in the media cannot get a rise out of me.
Based on your past, that seems like a good thing. Why medicine? Why the fascination? And when did you become interested in medicine?
I decided when I was 8 years old that I wanted to be a missionary doctor. I used to hear the stories in church and Sabbath school about missionary doctors traveling all over the world, great personal sacrifice to bring not only physical but mental and spiritual healing to people, and they seemed like the most noble people on the earth. So I decided that I was going to be a missionary doctor when I was 8 years old. And that was my dream until I was 13, at which time, having grown up in dire poverty, I decided I'd rather be rich. So at that point, missionary doctor was out and psychiatrist was in. I didn't know any psychiatrists, but on TV they seemed like rich people. You know, they drove Jaguars, they lived in these big fancy mansions, they had these plush offices, and all they had to do was talk to crazy people all day. So I said, this is great, this is what I'm going to do. But, you know, I was the local shrink in high school. Everybody brought me their problems. I would rub my chin, say, tell me about your mama. And then I did psych as a psych major in college, advanced psych in medical school. But I came to the understanding that my real talent had to do with eye-hand coordination, the ability to think in three dimensions. I was a very careful person, never knocked things over and said, oops. It's a good characteristic for a brain surgeon, by the way. And, you know, I put all that together. That's how I came up with neurosurgery. And then with kids, you know, with kids, what you see is what you get. You know, they don't put on a lot of airs. They don't have a lot of secondary agendas. And you can operate for 10, 15, 18 hours on a kid. And if you're successful, the reward may be 50, 60, 70 years of life. Whereas with an old geezer, you spend all that time operating, and they die in 5 years of something else. So I'd like to get a big return on my investment. But and frankly, on a serious note, you know, spending my whole professional career trying to save children and to provide them with longevity and quality of life is really the main reason that I'm doing this. Because when I think about their future, and I think about what we're doing to their future financially and in lots of other ways, and, you know, maybe the traditional politicians will fix it, but I don't see any evidence of that looking over the last few decades, and therefore I just can't sit idly by and watch it happen.
It's hard to characterize the main reason you're doing this, but focusing on what you believe needs to happen for the children of America, what are the top two or three issues that you want to address immediately, the most important things facing the country?
Well, I want to get our fiscal house in order. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said it's immoral to pass debt to the next generation. I mean, if we could somehow transport him to our time right now, he would probably immediately stroke out if he saw what we were doing. I mean, $18+ trillion of national debt. If you tried to pay that back at a rate of $10 million a day, 365 days a year, it would take you more than 5,000 years. And this is what we're passing on to our children. But that's the good news, because it's the fiscal gap that concerns me. And anybody who's not familiar with the fiscal gap, when you go home tonight, please look it up. I mean, this is essential that we all know about this. That's the unfunded liabilities that we owe as a government, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, governmental programs, all that we owe going forward versus what we expect to collect from taxes and other revenue sources. And those two numbers should be pretty close together if you're fiscally responsible. If you're not, a gap develops there. Bring it up into today's dollars and you got the fiscal gap, which sits at over $200 trillion. And the only reason we can sustain debt of that level is because we can print money. We're the reserve currency of the world. If we could not print money, I mean, Greece would look wonderful compared to where we would be. And we have to find a way to get that under control. It must become a priority for us.
We've heard for years it's unsustainable, and yet it has been sustained. Is it unsustainable now?
Well, it's sustainable until the house of cards collapses, and then it's not sustainable.
What collapses the house of cards?
Well, you can only tolerate so much debt. And what if we can't print money and we still have that level of debt? Now, you know, we are the reserve currency, but that's a title that generally goes with the number one economy in the world, which we have been since the 1870s until last year when China took over. Would they like to be the reserve currency? Would they like to be able to print money? Yeah, it would help them quite a bit with the situation they're in. But their system won't sustain it right now, fortunately for us, so we still get to be. But to me, it's just a warning. It's a blessing that we have this warning and we have this time that if we act intelligently, we can fix it.
Tell us about acting intelligently. What would you do to fix it?
Well, thank you for asking that question. first of all, we need to balance the budget. It's ridiculous what we're doing. And if we simply refuse to increase the federal budget by one penny for 3 or 4 years, that would balance the budget. I would do a lot more than that, quite frankly. I would call in all departmental heads and I say, I want you to reduce your budget by 3 to 4%. And if you can't do it, turn in your resignation now, because you're going to be fired. Anybody who tells you that there's not 3 or 4% of fat in all of our departments is lying through their teeth.
Give us an example of the fat. Say in defense, okay. Say in healthcare.
I'll give you an example. The federal government owns 900,000 buildings. We also own 2.4 billion acres and all the mineral rights. But let's just stick with the buildings for now. 77,000 of those buildings are either not utilized or severely underutilized. And yet, with taxpayer money, we are leasing or renting 500 million square feet of office space. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So, I mean, there's plenty of fat that can be cut. That's one thing. The other thing is, we have to understand that from 1850 until 2000, our average growth rate for our economy was 3.3%. From 2001 to 2014, it was 1.8%. That's a marked change. If you extrapolate that out over 20 years at 1.8%, you're talking about a $26 trillion economy. At 3.3, you're talking about a $35 trillion economy. That's a big difference when you've got all these unfunded mandates, unfunded liabilities to deal with. So you have to ask the question, how do we get that economy rolling again? Well, we have the most powerful economic engine the world has ever known. But what have we done? We have put all these fetters of regulations around it. And what people don't realize is that every single federal regulation, in addition to complicating people's lives, costs money. And that money gets passed on. You know, I remember, you know, when Dodd-Frank came along, you know, I've been in corporate America for a long time. A lot of people don't know that. You know, I sat on the board of Kellogg for 18 years, Costco for 16 years. I was the chairman of the board of Vaxinogen, a biotech company, in addition to starting with my wife a national scholarship fund. But so plenty of business experience. People think I don't have it. You know, it'll blow them away in business. But anyway, what we have to recognize is, you know, during all that, we would sit around the table talking about who do we have to hire in order to deal with this regulation and this regulation and this regulation, and we would have to hire them. Guess who gets to pay those costs? The consumer. So that's my point. Every regulation costs in terms of goods and services. Who gets disproportionately hit by that? Poor people and the middle class. It doesn't bother the upper class, but it hits those people disproportionately. Those are the kinds of things that are driving these income gaps that you never hear the Bernie Sanders or the Hillary Clintons talking about. And so we need to get the unnecessary regulations out, not the necessary ones. You know, our founders said if men were angels, no government or regulation would be necessary. But we know men are not angels, nor are women. Therefore, we clearly do have to have appropriate regulations in place. That's one thing. The other thing is we have an unreasonable taxation system. We need a system that encourages entrepreneurial risk-taking and capital investment, not one that depresses it. And just one last thing, in terms of the taxes, the corporate tax. We have the highest corporate tax in the developed world. And it is driving business out of our country. That's a no-brainer. And what I would suggest that we do is have a 6-month hiatus on the corporate taxes so that we could repatriate over $2 trillion of American money overseas. And that wouldn't cost the taxpayers one penny, and 10% of it, I think, should be utilized to create jobs for people on welfare and people who are unemployed.
Dr. Carson, there are many people, and certainly the Democratic presidential contenders who believe that American corporations in many instances are not paying enough, not paying, quote, their fair share. What do you say to that?
You might be shocked to hear that to some degree I agree, in the sense that we have all these loopholes and deductions and things that allow people to escape paying. I know a lot of people who make a lot more money than I do and pay considerably less taxes than I do because they have very slick corporate lawyers and they know how to, you know, manipulate the system. I don't manipulate the system, so I pay through the nose. And I don't like paying through the nose. I don't think anybody likes paying through the nose, but I think it should be fair across the board. And that's why I have advocated, you know, a flat tax. The reason I like that ideal is because it's based on proportionality. And I make no secret of the fact that I think God's a pretty fair person, and he advocated a tithing system. He didn't say, if your crops fail, you don't owe me any tithe. He didn't say, if you have a bumper crop, you owe me triple tithe. So there must be something inherently fair about proportionality. You make $10 billion, you pay a billion. You make $10, you pay one. And you get the same rights and privileges. And you get rid of all the deductions and all the loopholes so that nobody gets any special favor. And of course you have your people who say, but that's not fair, because the guy who put in $1 billion, he's still got $9 billion left. That's not fair. Well, that's called socialism. And that's not what built America. What built America was people said, that guy just put in $1 billion. Let's make the environment even better so next year he can make $20 billion and put in $2 billion. That's what built America. It was never built on taking and taking and dividing and redistributing. That's not America.
If we went to the flat tax, what has your analysis told you about what that would do for revenue for the country?
Well, the key is you have to get rid of all the deductions.
You can't have a flat tax and the loopholes and deductions.
Right, you got to get rid of all of them. And, you know, a lot of people say, I'll lose my house if I don't have a mortgage deduction. But they're not thinking, because the fact of the matter is your tax rate is so much lower, you don't need that mortgage deduction. And a lot of people say, well, churches will all disappear and all charitable organizations will disappear. They need to go back and read their history book, and you will see that charities thrived very well before 1913 when we enacted the federal income tax. And I think if people have more money in their pocket, they'll actually be more charitable, but they'll be able to give it to the people that they want to give it to. I think it's going to have to be somewhere between 10 and 15, probably closer to 15 in the beginning, but as we get things going, it will gradually come down.
You really believe charities won't suffer if there are no deductions for charitable donations?
I don't think so at all. You know, think about America. Think about the country that we live in, which you might be surprised to know we were the impetus for socialism. You know, the Europeans, they looked over here. They saw the Fords and the Kelloggs and the Carnegies and Mellons and the Vanderbilts and Rockefellers. And they said, you can't have a society like that where you have these rich people and then everybody's poor. You got to have a government that receives all the funding and then equitably redistributes it. Have you ever heard that before? You know, so that's how socialism got started. But what they didn't know is that we were different. All those names I just gave you. Instead of just hoarding money and passing it down from generation to generation, built the infrastructure of our country, built the Transcontinental Railroad, built the ports and the textile mills and the factories, which allowed us to create the most dynamic middle class the world has ever seen, which rapidly propelled us to the pinnacle of the world. As late as 2009, 40 of the wealthiest families in America agreed to give away half of their wealth to charity. Go to Africa or Asia or Europe or South America, ask the 40 wealthiest families to give away half their wealth. They'll look at you like you got six heads. This is an American phenomenon. When there's a disaster in the world, who's always right out front? We are. We're generous people. And we have to take advantage of that, because I can tell you, traveling around this country, speaking at a lot of events, you know, I've seen enormous success when people invest in their fellow human beings and personal relationships are developed and people are willing to put tons of money into it. And I've seen the results of that. And I have a very good inkling of what could happen in this country if we, if the government can just act to help coordinate and facilitate the goodwill of the people. Because I really believe it is our responsibility as the people to take care of those in our society. It is not the government's job.
Dr. Carson, from the audience, a common GOP theme is the need to make America great again, but America is the greatest country in history. What is not great about America?
Well, what's not great about us right now is that we've allowed the purveyors of hatred and division to have too much sway. And hence, they've convinced people that there's a war on women, that there's race wars anytime there's conflict between people of two races, that there's income wars, that there's age wars, that there's religious wars. And, you know, I don't believe it for one bit. But they've had too much sway, too much influence. And we, the American people, have got to understand that we are not each other's enemies. The enemies are those who are trying to convince us that we're each other's enemies. You know, because you disagree with someone on some issue, that doesn't make them your enemy. It doesn't mean that you want to destroy their lives and, you know, get rid of their employment and sue them. I mean, this is crazy.
Isn't the Republican Party and Republican leadership just as guilty in that regard as the Democratic Party?
Well, I got to tell you something. I'm not a highly partisan person. I think it is a huge problem. I don't care which party you're in. And the reason that it's so important that we stop fighting each other is because we have much bigger problems. And they're not Democrat problems or Republican problems. They are American problems. And when our financial structure collapses, if we continue down this road, it's going to affect everybody. I don't care what your party is. And if we keep fighting each other, we are, and we weaken ourselves. When the jihadists get over here, I guarantee you, they're not going to ask you if you're a Democrat or a Republican before they cut your head off.
Let's talk about, from the audience again, money and politics. How would you prepare to get the influence of money out of politics? Is that, it's a great bumper sticker. Is that ever really going to happen?
Well, I'll tell you how I'm personally doing it. I'm not going around looking for billionaires and licking their boots and asking
them
for
contributions. You have a very unusual way of fundraising.
I have no intention of ever doing that. I'm not going to get in the bed with special interest groups. I think that's abominable. And, you know, I simply said, if the people want me to do this, then the people need to fund it. And they have been funding it at record level. And we have no problem whatsoever in doing what we need to do without licking the boots and without bringing in special interest groups. And in a Carson administration, I got to tell you, the special interest groups are going to be out in the cold. We're just not going to deal with
them. Yeah, for those, and we'll move on to, there's a whole, obviously, range of issues we need to get to, but for those who don't know, Dr. Carson, by design, presumably, has fundraised in a very unique way in this campaign. Tell me what is, tell this audience what is different about the way you've approached it. You touched on it a little bit.
Well, basically, we've gone to the people. We have, you know, we're approaching 3 million Facebook friends, and they donate. We have over 400,000 donations, and the average donation is only, you know, around $50. You know, some of the letters are so poignant. You know, people on fixed incomes, and they say, you know, I can only afford to send $25 this month. But they say, next month, I'm going to send you $25 again. And the next month, I'm going to send you $25 again. And I got to tell you, I do not want to disappoint those people. I certainly don't want to waste their money.
We'll move off the money equation here for a moment, in a moment. But can you compete that way through the long term? You're up against, at least in the Republican side, Donald Trump, who has all the money in the world. And, of course, after the nomination process, things will change financially. But can you compete for the moment?
Well, all I can tell you is throughout my professional career, I encountered people who said, you can't do this. No one's ever done this before. That can't be done. And if I listened to those people, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. So, you know, I'm not worried about that, to be honest with you. And this is not to say that that we're not talking to some big money people, because we are. But we're making it very clear to them that they're welcome to donate, but they're not buying any influence. They can donate if they are on board with our attempt to save America in the way that we are planning to do it.
All right. Let's move into some of the major issues in this campaign. As a physician, you are uniquely qualified to talk about this in some respects. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, what's wrong with it? What would you do differently? Very specifically.
What's wrong with it? My God. Okay.
Was there a problem? Let me start this way. Was there a problem before Obamacare?
Yes, there was a problem before Obamacare. No question about it. And, you know, I was involved in trying to fix the system even before Obamacare, but working within the system. I don't think it's doable within the system because it was such a bad system.
And very quickly, because I want to walk through this with you because so people really understand, what was wrong with the system in your estimation? You saw it day to day.
Yeah, well, the biggest problem with the system is that we had a major pillar of it being insurance companies that made a profit by denying people care. It was an inherent conflict of interest. Plus, it was a big, unwieldy system that was incredibly inefficient. I shouldn't use the word was, it still is. But the thing about Obamacare that I really dislike is not that it doesn't work and not that it isn't affordable. What I really dislike about it is this is a country that was supposed to be of, for, and by the people, with a government there to facilitate life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. With Obamacare, along comes a government and says, we don't care what you, the people, think. This is what we're doing. We're going to shove it down your throats, and if you don't like it, too bad. Well, that's a completely different paradigm than what America was supposed to be. And what I have proposed instead is a health savings account system. Make health savings account available from the day you're born to the day you die, at which time you can pass it on. And I'm talking about the kind of health savings account that works like your savings account. You have control of it. There's not 600 bureaucrats in it. And you pay for it with the same dollars that we pay for traditional health care with. You wouldn't have to use as many of them. And you give people the ability to shift money in their health savings account between members of the family. So if you were $500 short, your wife could give it to you out of hers, or your uncle, your cousin, your brother, your sister. It gives you enormous flexibility.
Cover deductibles and that sort of
anything in the medical field.
But it would be up to me to save that money in that account.
Well, the money in the account, like I said, would come from the same sources that the money comes from now. It's just that instead of it going to buy a health insurance policy, it goes into the accounts and it's divvied up that way. It makes the cost of your catastrophic insurance dramatically lower because nothing's coming out of it except catastrophic health care. How often do you have that? It's like a homeowner's policy. With a large deductible. It's a very different animal than a homeowner's policy where you want every scratch covered. That's going to take care of 75% of the population quite easily. It doesn't take care of the indigent. Now, how do you take care of them? It's about, unfortunately, about a quarter of our population, about 80 million people, which is far too many, which we can fix if we fix the economy and we get the jobs available for people. But that's another story. Let's deal with what we have. We have 80 million people. We take care of them now with Medicaid. The Medicaid budget is $400 to $500 billion a year. That's a lot of money. If you divide 80 million into 400 billion, that's $5,000. $5,000 for each man, woman, and child. That's the allocation. What could you buy with that? A concierge practice. Concierge practices $2,000 to $3,000 a year on average, and still have a couple thousand dollars left over to buy your catastrophic insurance, which is much cheaper now. I'm not saying we should do that. I'm saying that's how much money there is. And look what could happen with that. If we begin to let indigent people have their own health savings account, a lot of people in Washington, D.C. say it won't work because they're too stupid and they can't manage something like that. But they said that about food stamps, too. And they did learn how to manage it. And they would learn very quickly not to go to the emergency room when it has a diabetic foot ulcer and pay five times more than it would cost to go to the clinic. They'll go to the clinic where and they'll take care of it also, but they'll say, now let's get your diabetes under control so you're not back here in 3 weeks with another problem. A whole nother level of saving that we are not realizing right now. That's the way you get the prices down and empower people, because now people are starting to think about their own health care. They're taking personal responsibility. We want programs that encourage responsibility, not programs that encourage dependency.
And that is the fundamental flaw in your judgment of Obamacare.
That's one of the biggest flaws. The flaw is that the most important thing that we have, our health and our health care, is being put in the hands of the government. That's not America.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Our guest is Republican presidential candidate Dr. Ben Carson. I'm Dan Ashley of ABC 7 News in San Francisco, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on radio. Catch up with us on the club's YouTube channel as well. Dr. Carson, while we're talking about health care and health-related matters, let's talk about, this is from a member of the audience, your comments in the past about Margaret Spanger of Planned Parenthood. Walk us through, do you regret anything you've said on that topic? Have you changed your mind at all?
No. What I've said about her is easily findable on lots of different places. She was a eugenicist. She made her feelings known about who she considered to be inferior, and she thought that it would improve the society by keeping those people from reproducing and by having the ones that she considered superior to reproduce. I find her to be a despicable person.
Let's talk about Planned Parenthood and the controversy over abortion. You are pro-life, but you want decision made within 20 weeks. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct at all.
Okay, tell me where you are. Forgive me.
I am pro-life. Having spent my entire professional career trying to save lives, working all night, many a night, on a premature baby to save their life, operating on babies still in the mother's womb, I think it's pretty easy to understand why I would be pro-life, why I would not sanction killing babies at any level.
And yet you have made a distinction between using material from an unborn child for research purposes versus what Planned Parenthood is talking about. Draw the distinction for people.
The distinction is quite easy. It's sort of like if you're on an archaeological dig and you find a tablet that has some writing on it, but you don't recognize that writing, and you turn it over to your archivist, and they go through all their archives, and they say, this looks like something from Mesopotamia, in the 5th century. And that's how you kind of figure out what the relationship is. We do the same thing in medicine. They have tissue blocks of every aspect of humanity, from a fertilized egg to people who are 120 years old. And they go back and they look at those tissue blocks and samples to help determine. So what I did in that research was provide the tissue, because nobody else has a way of getting into the middle of the brain and getting that. I gave them the tissue. They take the tissue, they compare it, and they were able to, figure out what were the origins of that tissue.
From the audience, as president, what would your position be on full-service reproductive health centers, including abortion?
I do not believe in abortion on demand. I simply don't, so I wouldn't fund it. And I know there are a lot of other people who don't believe in it, and they shouldn't be forced to fund something like that. If people, you know, I'm a live and let live person in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to put you in jail if you don't agree with me. But the interesting thing about America, if you look at the whole abortion issue, you'll see how opinions have migrated significantly over the last couple of decades. Why? Because now we have ultrasound, and we have endoscopy. We have ways of seeing that baby. You can see that baby at 12 weeks. You can see the little nose and the little eyes and the little fingers and the heart speed. It's real hard to say that that's not a human being. It's hard to say that that's a meaningless clump of cells. And as people begin to understand this more and more, they will not be very comfortable with the idea of sticking something in there and, you know, ripping its head off and pulling its arms and legs off. That's just, you know, it's the only way you can do that is if you can somehow in your mind convince yourself that that's not a human being.
As president, would you push hard to remove abortion rights, to change the Supreme Court ruling?
I would certainly be looking to appoint people who respected human life, who respected the culture of life rather than the culture of death, because I believe that this is a country that was founded on morals and values. And I believe that America is different. I know there are those who want to fundamentally change us and make us like everybody else, but we're not like everybody else. We're America. There is such a thing as an American way. There's no French way. There's no Canadian way. There's no Portuguese way. There's an American way. You can be un-American, but you can't be un-Nigerian. You can't be un-Swedish. You know, there is something that is very unique about this country. And we rose to the pinnacle faster than anybody else, and we rose to a higher pinnacle than anybody else. And it's because of the way we thought and did things. And it was because of the values that we had. And right now we find ourselves in a situation where we are busily giving away all the values and principles that made us great so we can be politically correct. And I think that's a big mistake.
The qualities and characteristics of America that you just outlined in broad brush are why so many people want to come here. Let's talk about illegal immigration. We have 13 million, roughly, people here illegally. Huge debate in this campaign, huge debate across the country, certainly here in California, about what should be done. Donald Trump has said, we'll throw them all out. What say you?
Well, first of all, I say you can't even begin this debate without securing the borders. And we have the ability to do that. We have the ability to do it. We just don't have the will to do it. You know, I was down on the border with my wife a few weeks ago, and I was just shocked. There was nobody guarding it. The fence that was there, it was the kind of fence we used to go over with no problem when I was a kid. I mean, there's nothing to it. There was one area where they had cut a big hole in it, and they repaired it by putting some barbed wire across there. The cameramen who were with us, they wanted to film us from the Mexican side, so they just went right through that. And they were not athletic people, and they had all their equipment. So I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just an open funnel. So you got to seal that, and we can do that. And then what you have to do is you have to turn off the spigot that dispenses the goodies, including employment. If there's nothing to come for, then people won't come. That'll stop the influx. Okay. Now, you still have to deal with the people who are here already. And, you know, it sounds really cool, you know. Let's just round them all up and send them back. People who say that have no idea what that would entail in terms of our legal system, the cost. Forget about it. And plus, where are you going to send them? So, you know, that's just a double whammy. What I have suggested is that we allow people to become guest workers, assuming that they don't have any criminal record or anything. If there's anything askew, they go. But they have a six-month window, and they can get registered. They can pay a back tax penalty. They can pay their taxes going forward, and they now exist above ground. Now, why is that an important thing to do? I was talking to a farmer in South Dakota recently. He has an 8,000-acre farm. He starts workers out at $11 an hour. He said he could not hire a single American, not one. And and I've encountered many others who've said the same thing. That farming industry would collapse. Now, there are those who say, yeah, but, you know, we need to have high, high wages. They have no idea what that's going to do to their food prices. They're being very naive when they say that. But it's also the hotel industry. There's a lot of industries. So if they're hardworking people who've been here working hard and they want to continue working hard and they have a clean record and they're contributing, I don't feel that it's practical to try to round them all up and throw them out. Now, it doesn't give
because them... Because it's expensive and impractical to do so, and because of the effect it will have on removing those workers who will work
you
at those wages.
You've got to look at factor A and factor B, and you've got to be pragmatic. You know, you can't do everything
based
on emotion.
Does it perpetuate that group as an underclass if you keep them here working at low wages?
I don't feel that that would be an underclass, because they still, if they want to become American citizens, can apply for American citizenship, but they have to go to the back of the line and they have to go through the same process as everybody else does. They don't get special treatment just because they've been here. And I think that's fair.
We can keep them out. Would you build a wall like some candidates, namely Donald Trump, has talked about? Or would you just add, what would it take to increase protection on the border?
A wall alone is not good enough. You have to have that wall monitored. There have to be people there. And when we were down in Arizona, there were people, but they were like 75 miles inland. At the wall itself, there was nobody. And I was talking to the sheriffs down there. They're so frustrated because they catch people, you know, they put them in jail, and then they get these things from ICE that says, let them go. And they're dealing with the same people a few weeks later. And there was one guy that said they deported him 20 times. He came back 20 times. You know, and there's no consequences to them. There's no help from the federal government. The federal government is doing nothing to solve this problem. That's why we need a different federal government.
You mentioned people making $11 an hour working on farms. Where do you stand on raising the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage? What should it be, and how should it adjust?
Well, you know, I think the appropriate thing to do is to actually have a national conference on the minimum wage and let everybody put their rationale for it, and let's look at it objectively. And let's decide what it should be, and it probably have to be changed or prorated for each state based on what the cost of living is there. But let's index it then to something so that we never have to have this discussion again in the history of America.
Race relations, making a lot of news, particularly with what has been happening with confrontations between people of color and police officers around the country. Hard to say whether they've increased or we're just seeing more of those incidents. Your take as an African American and as a political candidate and as a physician and as an American, where is America in terms of race? Is it as bad as we perceive it to be, or not so much?
Well, as a nation, we've made enormous progress with race relationships. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to acknowledge that, but, you know, having grown up in Detroit, which was a very segregated city with a lot of racism, and, you know, those who've seen the movie saw the depiction when I was in the eighth grade and I was the only black student and got the highest academic award, and one of the teachers got up and chastised the white kids how could you let a black kid be number one? You know, I mean, that's the environment I grew up in. I grew up in an environment when I went to Hopkins as an intern. I'd go on the wards. Invariably, a nurse thought that I was an orderly. Mr. Jones isn't ready to be taken to the OR yet. I would say, well, gee, I'm sorry, he's not ready. I'm Dr. Carson, and they turn 18 shades of red. And I would be very nice to them. And I had a friend for life. But, you know, I realized that from their perspective, the only black man they'd ever seen on the wards in a scrubs was an orderly. So why would they think something different? You know, and what happens is so often, you know, we get into this mindset where we let people, you know, rev us up and create, you know, hatred over just a misunderstanding. And I think that's something that can be resolved to a large extent from good leadership. And the other thing, you know, think about this logically. Are there rotten police that do bad things? Absolutely. Are there rotten news people who do bad things?
No,
absolutely.
Heavens no.
Rotten doctors, rotten teachers. Yes, of course. Do we go out and try to kill all the other ones because of that? Of course not. That is just a silly way of doing things. And we really, once again, need to sit down, people on both sides, with their grievances, with their solution, because we're smart people. And we can come up with solutions if we don't get in our respective corners and throw hand grenades at each other.
And that, you know, that sounds great in theory, but in practice, how does that translate out on the street where there's great animosity?
In practice, how it translates onto the street is we start taking police officers and putting them in communities. And you introduce them early and regularly, so that little Johnny's first encounter with a police officer is a pleasant one. Somebody playing catch with him. Guy that he knows all the time. You know, I was talking to a police officer in Baltimore recently. He says he spends a lot of time in a particular neighborhood that he patrols. He says he never has to buy lunch. He never has to buy dinner. People always say, hey, Joe, come on in. You know, I mean, that's how you solve that problem. It's relationships. When people know each other, it's a completely different situation.
How do you, from race relations to political relations, we were promised, the country was assured that when President Obama ran for office 8 years ago, that the acrimony would diminish in Washington and that we would work together. Politicians have said this as long as I've been covering news for 30 years. What makes you believe you can change that dynamic in Washington? Because people in many parts of the country have sort of checked out. They don't believe politicians anymore.
Well, I would...
Why should they believe you?
I would simply say that I hope over the course of time people will come to understand who I am, will go back and look at my history, and on the basis of that will know that, you know, I'm not just blowing smoke, and that, you know, I have no great ambition, quite frankly, to do this. But I feel called to do it by a lot of my fellow Americans. And the doors are opening, and I will do it. And I think, as a nation, we are incredibly talented people. One of the things that I've discovered, you know, through my decades of work in corporate America and, you know, establishing a scholarship program in all 50 states, as well as through my medical career, is the level of talent that we have in this country. I've also gotten to know a lot of military people and people in the government. We have really smart people. And if we utilize them together, what we can accomplish is mind-boggling. And what we've done instead is we've divided ourselves up into Democrats and Republicans and conservatives and liberals, and we let that dictate who we are rather than thinking about what actually makes sense. And again, we perhaps have not had real leadership. We certainly, you know, have not had it in recent past, not just this president. The previous president was, I think, so involved with the war and the war effort. He didn't want to cross anybody because he needed everybody to agree to fund what he was doing. And quite frankly, the administration before that, you know, it goes back a while. It goes back a while. It's not new.
Well, let's quickly, before we run out of time, jump overseas and talk about foreign policy. Was the deal with Iran's nuclear program a mistake? What would you differently?
It was a big mistake. And first of all, you know, I don't agree that it was a deal, because I think it should have been a treaty. And I think that Congress should have insisted that it was a treaty. There were multiple nations involved. It met all the criteria for a treaty. And if it was a treaty, then it would have to be approved by 2/3 of the Senate, which it never would have gotten. So that's what they should have insisted. But, you know, they let them snicker them. But at any rate, it's an executive deal, which means it has no standing with the next administration. None. Zero.
And if you're the next administration, what does that mean?
It means it will have no standing.
And you'd go back to square one and redo that agreement.
I would go back to square one, but I would know how to negotiate. You know, you can't have a negotiation that doesn't involve, you know, accountability and verification and enforcement. That's negotiation 101. We don't have that. You know, maybe I could get Donald Trump to help with the negotiation, but
he's done that in various walks of life. What do you perceive to be the major issues? We've talked about Iran. The major issues facing us overseas: China, ISIS, fight against terrorism.
There are so many, but
prioritize.
You know, in terms of what can result in our destruction fairly quickly, I think global jihadism. You know, a lot of people say, let's not get too involved over there, because in 2003, you know, we went and we invaded Iraq. It cost us a lot of money. It cost us a lot of lives. What did we get for it? We can't do that again. I do understand that, okay? But that's not really analyzing the problem, because this is a completely different situation. We now have global jihadists who are an existential threat to us. They want to destroy us and our way of life. And if we don't understand that, we're playing directly into their hands. And we have two choices. We can sit around and act like they're not that important. They're the JV. We can drop a few bombs in the desert and say we're doing something. Or we can use every resource available to us, you know, financial resources, military resources, overt and covert resources, to destroy them first.
Full-scale war against them is what you're describing.
I'm saying we need to do what we need to do in order to prevent them from destroying us. Their goal is to destroy us. And we have to be mature enough to recognize that we can't just sit there and let them do it.
Where would you fault this administration in terms of how they have handled that threat as an example of what we should do going forward? Have they failed?
I think they've sort of handled that threat the same way they handled the threat of illegal immigration. They don't do anything. They just let it happen. And they're not really doing much to thwart the goals of the jihadists, who have, you know, established their caliphate. You know, they've got half of Iraq, a third of Syria. They have a foothold in Tunisia and Nigeria. I mean, they're expanding. They're looking like winners, and that's why they're being successful in their recruitment efforts. Therefore, we need to be thinking about what can we do to take them out of the winner's circle.
Very quickly, before we run out of time, China and the huge trade imbalance with China, how would you deal with that?
Well, first of all, you need to recognize that, you know, the Chinese have been around for a long time. They're very pragmatic people. Honestly, when you look back historically, they're pretty reasonable people, But they also recognize weakness when they see it. And when they see it, they take advantage of it. And that's why, you know, the adventurism in the South China Sea, that's why they feel that they can attack us in cyberspace. That's why they feel that they can manipulate their currency and not pay any consequences for it. I think when they encounter a strong counterforce, you're not going to see them doing all of those kinds of things.
Last couple of questions, Dr. Carson. Your background, as we've described, how you grew up and the challenges that you faced, what made you, and I don't want to stereotype any group here, but what made you decide to become a Republican? Because that sometimes that background tends to tilt someone toward the other party. What made you a Republican?
Good question. Growing up in Detroit, you know, going to Yale, a bastion of liberalism, coming back to Ann Arbor, a bastion of liberalism, going to Baltimore, a bastion of liberalism. I was a liberal. I was a Democrat. I was a radical Democrat. And bought all the stuff that Democrats buy, including that Republicans were horrible, racist people. But as a young attending, seeing so many people coming in, able-bodied people, you know, dependent on the social system, I said, there's something wrong with this. And then I started listening to Ronald Reagan. I said, boy, he sounds reasonable. He doesn't sound like a racist. And I just really started thinking for myself. And that's really how I made the transition. And, you know, I was an independent for a long time. But when I decided that I was going to run, I had to evaluate which party would I run. And I don't think I would have been accepted in the Democrat Party. And also, you know, I'm a person of deep faith. So it became a pretty easy thing for me to decide. I'm also a person who believes in hard work and self-reliance and compassion for others. And when I define compassion, I mean providing people with a mechanism for developing their God-given talent so they can move up, as opposed to patting them on the head and keeping them in a subservient position.
Last question, so we can make a little news here today. You, on track to win the nomination, will you name Donald Trump as your vice president?
All things are possible.
Will you serve as his vice president?
All things are possible.
Our thanks to Dr. Ben Carson, Republican presidential candidate. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Dan Ashley. One big hand for Dr. Ben Carson, please. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.